A Thousand Lives Lived podcast. The podcast where a thousand lives come to life. Where mysterious creatures take flight. Where the blind lead and where space is transversible. A place where the imagination is unleashed. Anything can happen. Hi, friends, and welcome to the show. I'm Hazel Danes.
And I'm Tamara Lindsay.
And today we'll be continuing our new series on world building. But before we get going, we're going to go down the rabbit hole.
You start. What's your rabbit hole this week?
So I was actually just mentioning this. I've been researching more deeper into authors and looking at their websites and what they do for promotion on social media and a bunch of variety in like journeys from if you have a publisher, if you have a hybrid, if you are indie. It's very interesting to see what everybody's doing and to get insights.
Yeah, definitely. I think my rabbit hole, I have infinite rabbit holes sometimes, but my rabbit hole is I return to a rabbit hole I've been before, which is Bo Burnham. I don't know if you know Bo Burnham. He recently did a special on Netflix called Inside, which sort of captured the zeitgeist of being trapped inside during COVID. But he is an amazing creative person. He's wicked smart. He is a musical genius. He does, it's like the Mary Poppins thing of a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. He has comedy, but then he tells these truths to the audience or to whoever he's talking to that could be really painful if he didn't have a little bit of comedy in it. And the Inside special that he did was just, I mean, it sort of captured everything about being, about what the moment we're in. He's like Robin Williams or Shakespeare, seriously. He's fearless, yet he was having panic attacks on stage. I mean, it's amazing. So that was my rabbit hole this last week.
That's cool. Yeah, I've never heard of him, but I'll have to check him out.
Yeah, Netflix, he has a Netflix special that he made himself, all aspects of it. He recorded it and put it, much like you do, put it together and did all the lighting and wrote all the songs and played all the music and did everything, absolutely everything. So,
wow. Okay, so we're going to get started here. So our topic for today is world building, and we're focusing on magic. So we're basing our podcast on Brandon Sanderson's world building lecture series that he did at BYU, which was recorded in 2020. We're going to be posting links to his website and to the lectures, so please check those out. Brandon is the best-selling author of the Stormlight Archive, including books The Way of Kings and Edge Dancer, amongst many others. So be
He's
sure
very
to check
prolific.
Out yes, check out his website.
I would like to say first too, he is very prolific, and I think he is a maximalist in like all different senses of the word, in that he writes lots of books, he puts lots of stuff in his books. I mean, he's so, I think these laws sort of, I mean, that's a wonderful, like we were talking about before, that's the wonderful thing about doing these kinds of podcasts is we get to delve into each author's weird little world and what they do and how they approach life and stuff. And so I think it's good to think about his approach as being one of a maximalist. So
We're going to base our discussion on three laws that he presents in the lectures. So first law is foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing, laying down questions and then answering them and then staggering them and foreshadowing what to do with that.
And then the second one is adding flaws or limitations. And then the third is bigger is not necessarily better.
And once again, that's why I mentioned he's a maximalist, because that last one I think particularly applies to him, because he was doing like, I think he mentioned, what was it, like 10 magic systems with 10, I mean, like this insane amount of stuff. And he was talking about these, having all these things. And that is, I mean, it's for someone who is a maximalist, that's, it was a great point. Okay. So the first one was talking about, so this applies to world building on the page. A lot of the things he was talking about was not like the world building we were talking about before. We build the world in our own heads before we can put it on the page. What he was talking about was world building on the page. And so one of the things we do as authors is we put promises in our work. to keep people engaged, we stagger these promises. We may promise at the very beginning that there's this little mystery, but it's actually not the mystery that takes you through the whole book. It just takes you through the first one. And by the time you get that mystery resolved, you actually have the main mystery or another mystery that's proposed, you know, and you may have the mystery of one character and another character. So you have all these questions. And sometimes what happens, and Brandon Sanderson talks about this, is how the first book, his series, he, after he got it written and he turned it into his publisher came back and said, it doesn't have quite enough zazz, you know, it doesn't have. And so he took something he'd been writing in the second book and put it in the first book. But the problem was he hadn't mentioned, so the first book is about a certain type of magic and the second book is about another kind of magic. And so he brought this other kind of magic in at the very end to resolve the problem of the story. And so a lot of readers was like, you totally cheated. That was Deus Ex Machina, which if you don't know what that is, that just means God from the machine. It means like you have this wonderful historical fiction, then all of a sudden aliens come in at the very end and solve all the problems, you know, or like a robot does or whatever. Anyway, yeah. You have something that's totally not. And so what you need to do, and I do this, I'm very conscious about this in my work, and I had to something I had to figure out, is if you put something in at the end, you have to be very conscious about foreshadowing it in the beginning, or else it will seem like you cheated, even though you totally knew where it was going to go the whole time. Many people feel her books do the Deus Ex Machina thing, is My Sister's Keeper, Jodi Picoult. I love her Sister's Keeper, and I've used it sort of as a model in many ways. She said, I think, that she doesn't know how to do endings. She kills off a character at the end, like totally out of the blue. It's not set up anywhere in the book. It's just like we have this wonderful conflict and this wonderful thing going on. And it's very surprising what she does. And then she kills off her main character. Sorry to ruin it. I didn't mean to, but I did mean to ruin it. But I mean, you can't just, that was not set up. It was not part of, you have to like earn it as a writer. And so when you have something later in the book, you have to make sure you hint at it in some way earlier in the book. What is your experience with foreshadowing?
Oh, I totally agree with all of that. The whole concept of like, if you don't do it properly, you are essentially waving your author wand and just trying to close it off. Like, okay, that works to do that. And I'm not going to make the connections. I'm not going to make it make sense. And it just seems kind of artificial.
Right.
To do it like that. Like you need to like weave it in. And your degree of how subtle it is up to you, but it still needs to be there somewhere where maybe for Jodi Picoult, like her character goes and sees a tombstone halfway through the book and thinks nothing of it, or
dangerous things happen throughout the book that there's a reason why she dies in a car crash at the end, you know?
Right. Spoiler. I actually haven't read that book. Okay.
Oh my God, I am so sorry. But that, let me just say it, she could have cut that last part off and it would have been a better book. It would have been IMHO. It would have been a better book because that part was irrelevant to the rest of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is surprising, and I guess there is one justification you could make, but generally the rest of the book is actually very surprising and very well done. I mean, I'm not surprised that it's very well done because Jodi Picoult is a wonderful writer. I grew up on a ranch and we have all kinds of really crazy stories, but whenever any of my siblings tell these stories, people are like, that is unbelievable. And if you wrote that as a book, it would be unbelievable. And part of that would be for just what we're talking about, because the setup and fulfill, it's not what you expect. It's all these crazy things that are happening. And so sometimes what happens is you have too many promises. So Light from Uncommon Stars is a book I read recently, and it's wonderful. It's Ryoko Aoki, I think. I'm not remembering off the top. Names are just not coming to me today, but I think that's her. That's their name. It's a sci-fi book and then also like a urban fantasy book stuck together. And I was reading it as part of a book club, and some people, they were totally into it. I mean, it's amazing. It really is an amazing book. But a lot of people were like, this feels like two separate books kind of, and it's kind of a Deus Ex Machina that she uses the one genre to resolve the problems in the other. I mean, having demons and devils along with aliens, maybe
it seems
not.
A little bit busy.
Yeah, it was busy, but and I'm of a mixed mind how it turned out. But that's one other thing is you got to be careful how many promises you give, which is another that we'll talk about later. But so be careful the promises you give. Try to be really thoughtful about okay, I actually made a promise here. Am I going to fulfill it or not?
Right. And yeah, going back, that's part of the editing process.
For sure.
When you're editing, you trace your promises and how did you follow up? Did you follow up? You have to follow up. You can't leave things that's called an inconsistency, right?
Right, right. And even if you don't like resolve them and give closure, you have to have some sort of
some mention of it.
You have to address it in some way, even if it's replaced, there's a turn and it's replaced by a different question or something.
Right, because if you just don't mention it ever again, then you're essentially saying that wasn't intentional or it's not important, but it usually is important. Those sort of things, like you're just dropping the ball.
So right. Your subconscious is saying, hey, this is important. You should.
Yeah. Like what happened? Yeah. So setting up questions and answering them, that's kind of like, that's essentially the process of foreshadowing. By foreshadowing and ending, you're putting a question in front of the reader before something resolves it.
And sometimes you arrive at the answer before you have the question. And that's why you have to go back and put the foreshadowing in, which is the question earlier.
Right. Because usually answers are action pieces or they're dialogue or something. And the question is not necessarily an action or dialogue piece. It's usually an internal or circumstantial connection or something, you know?
So, right. And this is a great way to use what we were talking about before, which is scenes should not just do one thing. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's about this thing, but actually in the background, you're also foreshadowing something that happens later. And if you have a series planned out, you'll be foreshadowing things in the first book that may happen in the third book, if you've thought through what that's going to be, you know? Mm-hmm.
Second was adding flaws or limitations. I do remember this one because he said in the talk that limitations or flaws are more exciting than powers.
Yes.
I thought that was very interesting because he brought up Superman and I think he has a really good point and I've never thought of it like that, but like Superman is the hardest movie of the, you know, superhero genre to sell to people because he's just too powerful. They say like he's not got enough weaknesses and the weakness that he does have is just, it's almost artificial because if it's not present, it's not in the reader or viewer's head.
Like having a romance where everything just goes wonderfully swimming.
Yeah.
It's not that interesting.
No. So you want to have a superhero that actually doesn't fly that well, or that I thought of how Superman and Captain America are not, you know, the exact same people, but they are sort of similar, but you're drawn to Captain America because of his storyline where he got frozen for like 70 years and then he lost the love of his life. And he carries that through those Marvel movies. Like every Marvel movie, he mentions her and how it affects him that he could have had a life with her. And he just, through no fault of his own or just through fate, really, like he couldn't. And it's part of what makes him likable. It's not necessarily a weakness. It's just kind of like a little personal tragedy
that's what Brandon Sanderson says about the most interesting Superman movie is, I think, Superman 2. What's actually causing the conflict is his love interest, his relationship with his love interest. It's not the fact that he's fighting bad guys and all this other stuff. The conflict is actually him trying to, you know, get together with Lois Lane or whatever.
Right.
And so it's the same sort of thing as it's their personal lives that are causing the conflict. And I guess that's probably actually pretty true of a lot of superheroes. It's that they have a tragic backstory or they're having a hard time fitting in. Or, I mean, I'm thinking of Spider-Verse having a hard time fitting in. And yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think of the Hulk, where he is constantly and very obviously in those Marvel films, not okay with the big monster.
Right.
You know, like,
although I have to say, once Hulk becomes Zen, I love Zen Hulk, where he's like, just fine with himself, you know.
It is funny. That's my favorite Marvel movie, The Endgame. I could watch that perpetually, like just on repeat, because I just like love anything with time machines.
Oh, yes.
I'm a time machine person.
Okay. I love the Valkyries. Those are my favorites. And actually, limitations are interesting. Just in general, because I find like writing poetry, some people like to write poetry basically like they're writing prose, where they have no limitations, they just break it into lines. And that's interesting. But I find that having structures that I'm trying to do actually makes me be more creative. And so it's not only good to give flaws and limitations to your characters on the page, giving yourself as a writer limitations, whether you're going to write the book in this way. I mean, I've once wrote a short story that was a time spiral. So it starts at the point of the actual exploding of everything, and then it circles around and it goes a little bit in the past and a little bit in the future, and then it goes farther in the past and then farther in the future, and by the end it goes all the way around to when he dies and sort of very early in the relationship, and then it zips back to the front, to the present, and then his next action after this thing. And so having that limitation was fascinating, having that sort of this is what I'm gonna do, you know. Our last question is, bigger is not necessarily better. And as we were saying, Brandon Sanderson talked about how he initially wrote a book that didn't work because he had like 10 magic systems and like 10 protagonists doing all these different things. And he only did about 10% of the story. And his example was, it was better to have three protagonists with limited magic systems, you know, like one magic system or whatever. It's much better to go deep rather than to go broad. And as a
I can't even imagine creating 10 magic systems like
within the same book.
Yeah, like wow. And 10 protagonists. Like,
yes.
Like that just sounds like a mountain. How long does he take to write books?
Like, oh my gosh. And you've seen his books. They're like really, really big. I mean, you understand why. I mean, I get called a maximalist, and I have a hard time sticking to one protagonist. I'm a novelist by nature, I think. And so I always have to have at least three protagonists. And I thought of myself. And when he said 10, I'm like, that's even bad for me.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. One day I might branch out into the whole multiple point of views, but right now I'm just one point of view, one main protagonist. There's a buddy, there's a bad right. guy. Like I just keep it simple.
One of the things that interests me is looking at something from a different sides, or the challenge of try to make each person as different as possible and honor what their journey is, even if they're very different than me. And then see if I can give it a satisfying conclusion. Because I'll often start with like characters, and I'll be like, this is a character, this is a character, and this is a character. Okay, how can I make this into a story?
Yeah. And so he says, bigger isn't necessarily better. So diving deeper into what we're talking about, like magic systems, like and making the magic system more potent to the story and to the characters, like, in my head, a magic system, if it's done well enough, can be essentially part of every aspect of the book. It's part of the plot, it's part of the setting, it's part of the characters. It's just kind of woven into everything, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I love the example he used of a hollow iceberg. Advice is always your story should be like an iceberg. Your backstory and your whole world is like underneath the water, and you don't actually put it on the page. And what's on the page is above the water, the iceberg that's above the water. And that actually has really helped me in my, I think it was Hemingway that said that, it has really helped me, because I love going down research rabbit holes and I love building the world under the water, even if it doesn't appear on the page. It really helps me. But what he said, you remember him talking about a hollow iceberg?
Yeah,
he
I thought like, that was funny. And I thought that's actually very freeing, because...
Yes. So explain what it is.
Well, okay. So he essentially said that you, as the author, should allude to having this big world history built up, like all the details, the history of the world, like all the history of the cultures, everything to do with world building. Most of it's under the water, but he says it should actually be hollow, where... Right. Like you're alluding to the author having a knowledge of that world, but actually you haven't even planned it. You're right. Just like kind of
you just
subtly,
plan as much as you need.
You plan as much as you need. The way that he made it sound was like, okay, there's a visible iceberg, and then underwater you can see that it keeps going, so it's not all hollow.
Right.
There is a bit that you need to, in descriptive terms, like allude to, but most of it you don't have on paper.
I think it's important to trust your gut on when you're writing. So if you're writing along and something pops into your head you may discount it. But if you put it on the page, it can be that bit of visible backstory that alludes to a much larger world, even if you don't resolve what that is. I have literally had not the major questions, of course, but like fairly large questions, or like at least fairly large for the character, that it was alluded to in the story that sort of like comes out in dialogue or something like that. But I actually don't know. I know generally what they're talking about, but I actually don't know exactly what that means. I know as much as the reader does, basically.
Yeah. I just got done my first novel where, I know there's a book two, but I haven't fully planned it out yet. So I'm in book one, I'm alluding to things that I'm going to do in book two, but I haven't totally figured out what I'm doing in book two.
Yes.
So I'm setting it up so that I can develop it further later. But while I'm writing book one, I did not give all the details. And sometimes I kind of wonder, did that make sense to do that? I don't know. I guess.
Well, absolutely, because you can't keep a whole novel in your head. I always imagine the parts of a novel is like this huge bit of things of information swirling above your head. And it takes a lot of effort. You get your brain into it and you're like writing it and you're doing your research and you've got it all in your head. And then you go and take the kids to the doctor and it all just goes poof. Yeah. And then you have to be okay, let's get that back up there.
and then while it's swirling, figure out what is actually important.
Yes.
And needs to be there. And what is just fun? There's this fun part that I added halfway through my editing process where my main character finds these letters that his dad wrote to his mom. So his dad's not in the picture anymore. And he knows very little about him, really, because his mom doesn't talk about him. So he found these letters and they essentially just add some intrigue into explaining why the main character is the way he is. It's right. Assuming he gets things from his dad. And he's slowly learning also more about the town and the political structure of the town. So the letters are extremely revealing of where he lives and who he is and what he should do. But I don't do a lot of very obvious, I don't make it obvious for the reader. I make it cryptic.
So when you talk about writing that, did the letters just come to you as you were writing and they just sort of popped up when you were writing, or did you plan that ahead?
I had to do his dad's background story and have it clear somewhere. Because how do you write letters of a character that you haven't created really? So
yeah,
you can't
and
really
some
do
people
that.
Would stop and go create those letters so they would know explicitly what they were. And many of us would not. We just kind of go, okay, they're there. And when I need to know what they say, I will figure it out.
Yeah. So I thought, okay, no, I'm going to go back and do this whole character history, but most of it I haven't used, but I think I will use it. I just haven't used it.
Oh my gosh. In the Expanse, the character backstories. So the Expanse is written by two people under one pseudonym. And they have a character backstory for each of their characters. And what they did is they took those character backstories and put it into a novella. So they've got the whole, arc of the actual Expanse. And then the character backstories are each their own novella that's
Well, I was going to do a prequel. Because I made his dad's character interesting enough that he could be his own character of his own book all by himself. And also setting up this world, not telling everything about it. If you give a prequel, I feel like there's intrigue there. There's I want to know how that happened. How did that world happen? So then you explain it in a prequel. And then I also have a sequel. It was just fun to think of, I have this main character, this 18-year-old main character. What are his main traits that I'm making obvious? And how could he have gotten those from his dad?
Oh, yeah.
So I kind of did it backwards.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's often how it happens is you have this thing that ends up on the page and you're like, okay, how do I legitimize this? What sort of things led to this? And then that leads to character backstory and that leads to family, that leads to your world building. Actually, you're like, this thing occurs on the page. I need this thing. Okay. How did it happen? And that's when you start building your world around, you know,
yeah,
this is how it happens.
It was a lot of fun because it also revealed a lot about the mom, because the mom is obviously part of the dad's story as well, right? Because otherwise there would be no Malcolm. Right? Explains a lot about why she is the way she is, because she's portrayed as very simple, incredibly simple. Like, she's totally okay with her simple little life and doing the exact same thing and making soup on Sundays. And like, that's it. Mm-hmm. Whereas Malcolm is not. I presented like all of the ruckus of his dad and what happened to him made her think, no, I need to settle down and be safe and be inconspicuous.
Oh my gosh. This is exactly what happened with Virginia Woolf and Mrs. Dalloway. So she grew up in an aristocracy in England, and she had sort of contempt for the, you know, everyday women who just, the aristocracy who just submerged themselves in it and just took care of everybody else. And I mean, she had respect, but she also like, what vapid women, you know, they're not interesting. And then she wrote Mrs. Dalloway because she was interested in that. And she realized that their inner lives were just this amazing thing, but they had just repressed it all. And so Mrs. Dalloway is about her discovering this, sort of. I mean, and it's also about her portraying what she thought of. I'm sure she went into it kind of like with a love-hate kind of thing, and then came out the other side understanding a lot more. It's the same sort of thing.
Yeah. And I haven't read it, but I wonder if she even went into it with all of her thoughts and feelings on the topic and with an intent of even bringing out how annoying this or how like
satire kind
of. Yeah, like a satire sort of thing. But then you can change how you feel about things after you write about them.
Yes, absolutely. And what you were saying before, I think, is really important too, about how you don't know what's going to happen in the second book. J.K. Rowling writing Harry Potter, they say, oh, she had it all planned out. She knew what the ending was. I have no doubt she knew what the ending of the seven, and she had sort of had a rough breakdown of what the books were. But you and I both know she did not know what all the characters were going to be. She did not know what all the scenes were going to be, because those only occur when they're on the page. You might have like an idea, like, I want to have this scene and I know I want this character. And I mean, she was going to kill off Hagrid at one point, and she ended up killing off one of the Weasleys instead. I mean, yes, absolutely. She knew what the ending was going to be. She wanted to be sort of Christian with him dying. And sorry. If you haven't read Harry Potter,
I haven't read Harry Potter.
Oh my God. Sorry.
Oh, dear.
No, but he doesn't. No. Sorry, I got to watch it. I'm going to do all these spoilers. But anyway, she did definitely know what the ending was going to be, but she didn't know what the middle was going to be. And just like you were saying, you don't know what the plot is of the next book. I mean, you don't. When I was writing The Language of Corpses, I had no idea that a character from the beginning of the book was going to end up being pivotal at the end. And when I was writing the beginning part, I was having so much fun because I was very, very, what's the word for it? I was doing it on purpose. I would present a whole cast of characters. I wanted this to be a social book where there's a bunch of people, not just like one lone wolf, right? So what I would do is I would, for pages, I would have a paragraph or two about each of the characters that are involved in this, right? And so I introduced like 10, 12 characters over the course of like five or six pages, where I just have a little bit of paragraph about what they look like, what their backstory is, what their quirks are, right? And I had no idea at that point how those characters were going to play through the rest of it. And some characters do one thing or another thing, and then one of the characters end up coming back at the very end and being very pivotal. But I did not know that when I wrote that.
There's a clicking point when you're writing where you're like, okay, so I've got an ending.
Yes.
I've got to make it incredibly interesting and also kind of interesting, but I'm not solving anything technically, especially if I want a sequel. I know what you're talking about. So it is very interesting. I think it's also, I'm going to say it interesting again, but it's interesting that you didn't know that that character was going to play that role. You just, who can I choose to do this role that needs to be done? And
And it has to be somebody that's already introduced. I mean, that's part of the presenting questions part. Okay, if I create a totally new character for this role, I have to go put them in earlier or else it's going to feel really weird. Or I can pick a character I already have.
Right. And that makes them even more interesting. I need to figure out a different word for interesting. But
amazing.
Amazing and fascinating. There we go.
Fascinating.
That makes them more fascinating because you're saying that they're multifaceted. They're not just that way that I portrayed them like chapters and chapters ago. They've got a whole 3D person to them history and a past and bad things that have happened to them and ways that they've responded and blah, 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 blah.
Another way to look at this, I'm just thinking now, is revealing new information, rate of revelation. Have you ever heard of the term rate of revelation when it comes to writing? You know, when you're reading long and you're reading a book and it gets really boring or it gets saggy in the middle, or you're reading a book that's like really, really exciting, a lot of it has to do with rate of revelation. And that means how often are you presenting new stuff? Mm-hmm. And I think this is why Dan Brown is away with having literary crack, is because his rate of revelation is such that you just have to read on. So how often are you introducing new things, changing things up? You know, if you're describing setting, is it also doing double duty as furthering the plot or whatever? And so if you have a regular rate of revelation, people will want to keep reading. But if you let that slack, you're not bringing in new ideas, changing things up, surprising your reader, then it will get boring. You know, that's a kind of a smaller way to think about a different but smaller way to think about question and answer. If you keep bringing up new questions, small and large, and resolving old ones. Yeah.
The rate of revelation. That's interesting. Because, of course, it can't be like so fast that they don't have a clue what's happening. But
right. You gotta let them breathe every once in a while.
Yeah. And I think like the hardest part of rate of revelation is when you feel like you're trying to set up the book.
Because you can't have like info dump.
In order to understand plot change or a change at all, they have to understand the world and the character, right? And then you have to make them care. So they not only do they understand, but they also care.
Right.
So
it helps me to kind of trust the reader and say, okay, the person I'm writing for is smart. And I'm just going to push them in. I'm just going to plunge them in the middle of the situation. And I will give them little bits of backstory when they need it or setting or whatever. You know, I'll just feed it to them a little bit at a time, just like I'm feeding the plot to them at a little bit at a time. Because otherwise, then you end up with the Dickensian. And then their parents and then their grandparents were born on this planet. And then they were like this. And then they immigrated, you know.
Like, okay. It's a pretty good list of laws, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And then let me see. What was the zeroth law? Oh, make it interesting. That was his final little zeroth law, I think.
Did he say as awesome as possible?
Awesome as possible. That's what he said. Or somebody else said, leave out the boring bits.
And the boring is kind of, it's hard to know what's boring, right? The key to knowing how good your book is getting a bunch of different people to read it.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people to read it before you publish it, preferably.
Yeah. Well, and even then you'll have some people that it's just not my cup of tea, you know? And
right.
So you gotta, yeah.
So it's tricky business. Just for your information, Brandon Sanderson does have many other lectures that he's posted on YouTube. So if you want to type his name into YouTube, there's lots of other sessions to check out. And we might even be featuring another one of his sessions.
Yes.
Today, we've decided that Tamara and I are going to be reading a book a month and basing our two podcasts for that month on the book that we're reading. We'll be posting information on which books we'll be reading so that you guys can be reading them with us. We'll be talking about titles that everybody knows about and authors that we are all familiar with, like Bernard Cornwell, Andy Weir. We'll mostly be focusing on sci-fi because that seems to be what we both like to read.
Yeah.
But we are going to try and diversify our list a little bit here and involve some romance and some.
We'll be doing other projects. I mean, we're doing a world building project where we're working on a fantasy novel together. I mean, it's going to be exciting, so you won't want to miss it.
Yes, definitely stay tuned. Okay, well, that's all for today. Over and out.
Over and out.
also, very exciting, we do have our 25% off promo code for any publishing packages available on our website. So if you're an author and you have a manuscript ready for publishing, please do use this promo code. It's only for our podcast listeners. So get a pen and paper and write this down. The code is Happy Publishing. Again, it's Happy Publishing. Use this code when you're checking out or when you're submitting your manuscript. So just to be very specific here, go to submissions on our website and submit your manuscript. In the message box, be sure to type in that code. So type code and Happy Publishing, and we'll get you that 25% off any package. And remember, that's only for our podcast listeners. We're not giving this away on our social media accounts. So it's just a very big thank you to any listeners who have manuscripts ready for publishing. So thanks again, and we can't wait for our next episode here. Well, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to our channel. We've got some great shows coming up with amazing practical advice for writers, and for the bookworms, fun features on new and exciting books soon to be released. You don't want to miss out. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for all the updates. And if you'd like to be on our show, pitch us your idea on any of our pages. Until next time, keep writing, keep reading, and you'll live 1,000 lives.